Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. This week, I'm joined by Shane Armstrong. Well, thanks for taking the time to do this. I'm really looking forward to it because I think you're, from what I've heard, your background is really interesting.
It's a mix. Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, so I've always been a software developer in my professional career. So the military stuff, I was just a reserve soldier in Royal Engineers in London. Prior to that, as a teenager, well, I joined that as a teenager, I was 17, 18. And prior to that, I was an army cadet when I was 13. So the environment I lived in was quite built up in London. So there's a lot of concrete and glass, you know, a lot of people in a very small area. And it was just, we'll come to that later anyway. So I was an army cadet and then I joined the army reserve. And I was always into computers in one way or another as a kid. And so I kind of like, that kind of like died down a little bit when I turned about 11, 12, 13, as it does, you know.
Yeah.
And you discover the outside world, and which I did with the army cadets. Like I said, we'll talk about it later. And then I had to leave the army cadets because I was too old. You know, I was like 17, 18. I was about 18 and I was like, I didn't really want to stay another year. I was joining the Army Reserve, which used to be called Territorial Army back then.
Oh, okay. Yeah, got you.
This is back in the 90s. Yeah, I can't even remember now. So far away, yeah. So long ago. I did that for about 4 years, but I injured my back quite badly about halfway through that four-year service. Mm. It just wasn't clearing up. And then it got to a point where it's like I could manage it, but I wasn't really doing much, and I got a bit bored with the Army Reserve. You know, we were doing the same old stuff, and there wasn't really much going on because this was after the first Gulf War, like, you know, several years after the first Gulf War. Not that I'm looking for action, just to be clear, I don't advocate war or anything like that.
Yeah.
But you know, you're in there to serve where you should be anyway, and there's some expectation that you could be called up for service, which some of my family members were. And as reservist, yeah, my uncle was, and I have another cousin in Australia. He was called up, but I think that was for Afghanistan. He did some service in Afghanistan and Iraq, but I'm not going to go into details about that. But yeah, I think I was just yearning for a challenge, you know, outside, yeah. You know, software development and learning how to work computers, should we say, you know, and get some useful output from them, you know, put them to use and for business. Reasons, you know. And I was in the Army Cadets 13, 17. I'm joining the Army Reserve 17. I left when I was about 20, I think. And
right.
I joined the Special Constabulary.
Right.
Okay. So again, that's reserve.
Yeah.
It was a reserve, not the strictest sense, but we don't have a salary. It's no salary at all. But that was quite challenging. That was completely different than the army training.
Interesting.
Like, completely different. Completely different. And I was warned that as well. By the instructors at Hendon. So I was with the Metropolitan Police Special Constabulary, and I was warned by an instructors because they knew my background, and I think they were kind of hinting it's not going to help you too much
really, here,
you know. So you have to think on your own feet. You have to make your own decisions.
What was the army training actually like?
Oh God, that was tough.
Because I mean, we see adverts all the time on the telly about you know what it's like to be in these positions, but. What's it actually like? I mean, is it like the TV programs which you see where they kind of like you're in your barracks and they, you know, they're hitting cooking pans with wooden spoons to get you up and all that? What's it actually like day to day?
I wouldn't say it was like that. I mean, it might be, I think it's a case of if you didn't wake up in time in training school, I mean, you'd know about it. I mean, you'd get punished, if we say. So you go for a run, do some press ups, and they would, there has the phrase beast you.
Right,
we beast it sometimes, you know, like we made little mistakes here, and it's like get down on your crouch down, hands up, and then run up that hill. I mean, that's incredibly difficult.
Yeah,
like, you know, and you've been up for like 2 days as well. But well, I joined. I was at a Royal Engineers unit. Actually, I was at two. So the first one had a it's attached to Free Commando Brigade. Mm. So the initial recruit training. For that was quite tough because then you had to quickly transition to the commando training. And that's where I went sort of, that's where my luck ran out because I was running 35 miles a week. I mean, you can see I'm quite a slim person.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm quite a slim person, you know. I'm 5'11", and I'm about 70 kilograms now. I used to be about 63,
wow.
64, 65.
Wow.
So I had to eat a lot of burgers and push a lot of weight to actually really bulk myself up, because when you did your, like I said, did your initial recruit training and you become a private, you're a trained soldier. Okay, so everyone really learns the basics, the same stuff to a certain degree. I mean, there's some specialities towards the end, you know, like an engineer unit, we were learning how to use tools and stuff like that. An infantry soldier wouldn't get to that necessarily. I'd be quite surprised I got to that in the basic training as a reservist. Okay, so I can't speak about the regular training, which is much more extensive and has much longer duration because you're a professional. But anyway, we did the initial recruit training. That was at Gibraltar Barracks, along with all the other Royal Engineer recruits. Yeah, I mean, you had regulars there as well, but we were in our own squadron, which is the TA squadron. When it got to the commando training, I mean, it's like you weren't even allowed to walk anywhere. Like, even in the TA centre, it's like you had to wear webbing with, I can't even remember how much weight there was in there. It was
really,
yeah, you had to use sand and pack your not your kidney pouches, but your ammo pouches and your utility pouches at the back.
Wow.
At the front as well.
Did you know it was going to be like this before you joined?
Well, I was a bit naive, you know, let's be honest. You know,
I imagine it's quite difficult to find out what it's actually like. That's why I'm so interested in this.
Ask a Royal Marine Commando it's literally mentally taxing, you know. I was a small person as well, and I nearly broke my ankle, so that's it. So I never got to Limestone. So I think it was like 6 months training, and then you go to Limestone, and then I think it was 6 months, and then you start doing your commando weekends. Okay, I think you did about six, and I can't remember, I might be wrong. And at the end of that, you take your all-arms commando course, which is designed for the army.
Well,
I think it was much shorter in duration as well. I don't know if that's good or bad. I think some people might say it's easier, but that's quite controversial, so let's not go there. Never made it to Limestone, but I had two stabs, and then I first time I nearly broke my ankle, so my ankle was just out here and I couldn't go. So you got an opportunity every 6 months, so I lost the opportunity. So first time I was there, and then second opportunity, I tore something in my back, because I just did like a 10-mile run with weight, and I went to do some weights, and I just arched my back and I pulled it up, and something just pulled between my shoulder blade and my spine. Now, that never cleared up. So that was quite, because I could do all the tests. I could do the man carriers. I mean, I had to mount, you've got to do a 200-meter man carrier, one of the commando tests. But I used to get paired with this guy who's the size of a guardsman. I mean, he must have been like 15. Yeah. I think he's about 14, 13 stone, which is a lot.
Plus
all his 22 pounds of webbing and the rifle as well. And it was like, that's how much bulk, that's how much muscle I'd put on, that's how much training I was putting in. I was training 6 days a week for months on end. But the thing is, I never had anyone, because I was a teenager, and I realise now just how vulnerable, you know, I just realised I had no one really keeping an eye on me. You know, to looking at the type of training I was doing, the way I was doing it, the surfaces I was running on. I got shin splints at one time. And I think I was just too young and I was just too naive. And the way I was doing the training was, I wasn't correct. And so there wasn't much sort of support there. I mean, you got support during the drill night, which was like every Tuesday evening. And you got support during the weekends. But I just realized, I never, looking back now, as a manager, you know, as a software engineering manager, I suppose with that lens, I think I needed a little bit more support. But, you know, that's just the way it was then. I imagine it's difficult for, you know, reservists to get that during the day, because like they got the drill nights and they got the weekends. I mean, that's it. Like, you know, that's your exposure, apart from your annual leave, I mean, your annual exercise and some other weekends and training that you can do and other opportunities. But it's very difficult to get that coaching and support, which you kind of probably need on a daily basis, like what the regulars get, you know, do their PT sessions and the training. You know, they're being watched, things are being noted, and you've got your instructors keeping an eye on you and their experience as well. And they can see which way you're trending, you know, are you going to get injuries? So that was my experience. And then I transitioned, I had to return to another, I transferred to another engineer unit in London, which is an EOD unit. So, you know, I started blowing things up. I'm not saying there's I blew up a few things as an army cadet, which is an amazing experience. I really do advocate people sort of getting some, you know, people who've got parents as well, who've got children, you know, get them into this that sort of like structured, funded organization, youth organization. I'm a great advocate of that.
Would you say that when you went in to the army training and all that, in that part of your life, and then when you came out of there, were you very different, the person going into the person coming out?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. What it made me realize is, focus and hard work, yeah, makes you luckier, right?
Yeah.
And, sometimes you've got to be a little bit too careful, you don't push yourself too hard. You make sure you've got the right support and coaching. Coaching is important.
Yeah.
Like a professional athlete will always have a coach for all sorts of reasons. But, focus and determination and actually believing in, understanding what the end goal is and kind of some objectives to how to get there and break it down, break that problem down because, being able to run, a half marathon, just a simple example, it's something you can't just do overnight. You really got to plan that out. Mm. You've got to speak to your family as well because you have to go running quite often and your diet's going to have to change and you have to look at the terrain you're running over. So, for me, it's like the stuff I was doing in the Army Reserve and the Territorial Army, I didn't think I'd be doing that as a child, running half marathon with weight on my back, and just because I was quite a skinny kid, so I felt quite sort of disadvantaged and had a psychological effect on me as well. It was like a lot of my peers, they're like teenagers as well or young people in their young 20s and maybe you get one or two in their early 30s. Which is quite old, in army speak, army sort of environments. I was quite sort of, cognizant that I felt I was impoverished. But yeah, the psychological aspect is quite important too.
Mm.
To answer your question, did it change me? Yeah, it did. Yeah, it changed me because of what I just said. I was much more aware of, the enormity of what I was doing. At that particular, that first TA unit I joined, and just how difficult it was and just the amount of respect I had for the people who actually got to the end of that, and that's regulars and the TAs as well. And I had a lot of respect for the TA and the reservists because, like I said, they didn't have much support, on a daily basis like the regulars did. And they really had to get their day jobs, they got the family, and they still have to get all that training in. All that physical exercise,
unbelievable,
amongst all their things. So that's a lot of planning. That's a lot of dedication, and has an impact on family life as well.
Mm.
And to be able to do that is a great feat, to get that green beret off, or to pass out, or to get some speciality in a non-commander unit as well. That takes a lot of doing as well. So anyone that's in the reservists, I've got respect for them, and not just the regulars.
Yeah. What did you learn about leadership when you were there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So my role wasn't a leader. I was expected to be led. However, that was my expectation. You're sort of like that trench there, that target there. Go take that out, okay? You expected to get some direction in the field. So as an army cadet, I was what was my rank? Company sergeant major. So I'd actually, we're all young teenagers and kids, we took it seriously. Like we were in a uniform,
Yeah.
We had like rifles and we had like blank rounds and. We had objectives and I learned sort of sometimes it's better to make a decision quickly than to sort of procrastinate, that's the thing. That's what people expect you to do. They expect you to sort of like, some people just want some sort of direction quite quickly.
Interesting.
And under those circumstances where you're actually in contact with the enemy, I guess, you have to make decisions quite quickly.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on around you. Yeah. Critical decisions. So anyone that's, who actually has operational experience, and you have a great amount of respect for them.
Mm.
One thing I did learn was that teamwork was so important in those sort of situations. You really had to depend on everybody. It really was about, who's the weakest link? That is your strength. That's about as strong as you are. And keeping an eye on everyone around you, looking around and make sure no one's straddling you. So in that sort of role, in that sort of job, you can see people lagging because there's a physical distance, when you're in an office based role, you don't have that because people are all sort of static, aren't they?
Yeah.
But they can distance themselves sort of metaphorically, psychologically as well. And that's a little bit harder to spot sometimes. So I think it's, you get quite early feedback when you're in the field from your peers and your colleagues. Whereas in the office, it's a little bit harder, I think.
Yeah,
that's
really?
A little bit harder to get that feedback. Well, yeah, because some people are quite, someone's hurt their back You know, so, I mean, you're going to know about it because they're going to say, my back's hurting, I can't. Or they, so you have to lighten the load. And you take the, yeah. Some people would spread the load across the team and you it, and, or you go a little bit slower, you know, or you take some more breaks, more water breaks, you know, and, you know, maybe share some of your rations, give them a little bit more, I don't know, sugar, that sort of thing.
It's physical, isn't it?
Yeah, it's physical, you know, but you still have the same things kind of happening in the office environment, you know, in the civilian role.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of complexities there as well. So yeah, that's teamwork is really important, and you're only as strong as the weakest link. That's what the army taught me, because it's like obvious, it's overt. So I was in that for 4 years, and then I just left and I transitioned quite quickly to special delivery, like really quickly, because I've seen an advert on TV, never even knew about it. And I just thought, wow, that would really, because like I was quite comfortable being in uniform, because I used to be an army cadet, so I was kind of used to that whole environment, you know, and I was, I didn't think it would, I mean, it would help me in a civilian life, and I realised with my back, like, it wasn't clear enough. I managed to fix that, by the way, but we won't talk about that, it was quite simple, it's ridiculous, years of back pain, and, like I said, like, earlier, I said I was warned that having some military background or some training wouldn't help me too much in the police. You've really got to think for yourself, is what I was told. You know, you've got to. I don't think people in the military can't think for themselves. So I didn't quite agree with that. So I have to be honest, I didn't quite agree with the sentiments that were put forward to me. But anyway, that's what I was told. The way I read that is you've got to be more confident, because you're wearing a uniform. You are like. You represent the state at some particular level. You represent the state, and you represent the community as well. Okay, so you are an official in uniform, and there's no one else around to help you sometimes. Like, you're out there, you're walking down a road. I can't tell you how exposed I felt my first day. Apparently, I looked like a teenager, because it was. I looked like about 14, someone told me. People were stopping me in the street and said, you're far too young. How old are you?
Oh, no.
And I remember the first person who came up to me when I was uniform, they said, they asked me for directions. And I said, I don't know. And I said, you're a policeman. How could you not know? I said, it's my first day. I've only been doing this for like 30 minutes. But let me see. I can ask my sergeant, well, my supervisor for directions. But the thing is, the confidence, I realised just how little confidence I had in a lot of situations I didn't. So I had like this massive blind spot. Yeah, that was quite informative, and I found it quite challenging to be a uniformed police officer. You know, even if they're a special constable, you still hold a warrant card and you're wearing a police outfit, you know, and you're functioning as a police officer, you know, you're part of a team at a particular time. And I just realized what made me realize is that I'm really good at sort of calming people down. Okay. Because I'm not a big person. I think people feel particularly threatened by me, in a good way. You know, I've only pulled my truncheon about two or three times over about two decades. The number of reasons being, sometimes you kind of pull out because there's not enough room to pull the thing out, and then you're hands-on, you're trying to get handcuffs on somebody else, sort of one-on-one. I just realized, you know, it just meeting people halfway is really important. I mean, there's a phrase there, isn't there? There's a proverb. So meeting people halfway is it's the most important journey you can make in life.
Yeah.
I realized, because I was quite a small person, I'm thinking, do I really want to aggravate people just because I'm wearing a uniform, just because I have authority? Do I really want to be aggravating people? Do I really want to be leaning on that as my first port of call? No, I don't want to be doing that. And that's not a mature way to go about it. And that's not what the public expects. You know, they expect you to
diffuse,
you know, keep the peace and have good manners as well. That's the most important, have good manners and just realize you're there to serve people as well. You're there to serve the community. You're not just there to enforce the law. You know, and you've got to find the right tension between those two sort of, some would say, I don't know, competing sort of threads, you know, aspects. But you can blend them, you know, and you can make them work together. And then I think you just got to be a bit mature about it. And sometimes you have to be quite, you know, firm with people because they're not listening, or they're going to get away, or they've done something quite serious.
Yeah.
They've hurt somebody, or they're trying to kill somebody, or whatever, you know. And so you have to chase after them. You're going to have to go hands on. I mean, there's no two ways about that. You can't be nice about the way you can do it. But once you've held on to them and use reasonable force as well, you know, you've got to remember, you've got to use reasonable force. Mm. They have friends, they've got families as well. You know, you can't just treat them like an animal. And you're not there to judge them. That's the most important thing, that you're not there to judge people. You're there to serve people. And I think that's kind of influenced my leadership style, because I've always tried to get the best out of people. That's how I approach my team members. I always try to get the best out of them rather than the most out of them. But whenever I'm looking at a piece of work, or whenever I'm looking at a bulk of work that's coming our way for maybe the next quarter or the next 6 months, I'm always thinking about, okay, where are the opportunities here for my engineers, okay, for the company's engineers that I'm helping and I'm serving? So I'd say, yeah, servant leadership style. And I think it works quite well. What I do like to see is the team sort of self-organizing. I don't want to be there directing all the time, because that is just going to kill productivity. It's going to kill creativity. It's going to literally, you know, impoverish people. And so those things report to me. You know, a team that's able to self-organize, that they've got an environment where they can do that. They can talk openly. They can challenge me. I'm okay with that. I've got a good personal relationship each individual in my team. Mm. And it's something I have to maintain as well. Trust as well is important.
Yeah. If I can just jump in there, there's a point that I really want to make, which is, you know, you've essentially through those two careers in the army and the police, you've learned two different approaches to leadership, really, because from what you were saying, I get the impression that in the army it was very much team focused, and then with the police it was very much individual focused on yourself and kind of managing. First of all, would you say that was the right take on it?
I'd say also the military one's about selflessness as well. So being selfless, I mean, you're making sacrifices. You're potentially making sacrifices. You're putting yourself in harm's, not that I ever did. I have no operation experience in the Army Reserve, but there was always that potential, and you always exercise that way as well, you know. And then the police was about one, it was sort of highlighting my blind spots as an individual. And two, it was making the best representation I could for the service I was working for and the community I was working for as well. And, you know, being being a mitigating sort of a calming influence, you know, between the regulars who are, some of them are quite, you know, overworked and stressed as well, you know, and just, you know, taking some toil away from their particular circumstances. And, And again, having, you know, come across people that were quite vulnerable and just giving them some mentoring, and really just because I'm a special as well. I have time. Mm. I had always a little bit more time to engage with people that come to notice and find out a bit more about their circumstances. So, you know, some people have been abused by their father, and then they came to London, they were homeless. And then 6 weeks later, they're on heroin. You know, they're completely drugged. I mean, their lives are just ruined, you know, one end of the spectrum to the other. So, yeah, so I think, like I said, to answer your question, selflessness as well with the military and police as well, you know, just hiding my blind spots. And again, just sort of getting I think I've had quite a decent upbringing. You know, I haven't had an impoverished upbringing. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from a single parent family background. So my mother brought me up. So I wouldn't say it was perfect, you know. Mm. There's always gaps there, you know. It kind of helped me sort of get more in touch with what the reality of life is like, rather than sat behind a computer. Whereas, like, you know, it's important, like, you know, I, all the professional roles I've had as a developer, they've all been important. They've all served a purpose, to, you know, to help the community, to help particular areas of society as well. So it's always had a purpose and a function. I just felt, you know, I had particular skills where I can help mediate. I could also engage and deal with violence. I was quite happy to do that. I didn't say it was fun. I never looked for it, but I was quite happy to do that. I had to. So I can go from one extreme to the other. You'd have to do that in the police, going from one extreme quite quickly to the other. You had to act really quickly. That's something I learned too, you know, looking for those warning signals. And so, you know, loads of like different life skills there, learning about body language and how just looking at, you know, what's in front of you and like knowing what people are thinking about them actually telling you. That's been really useful as well. So loads of like, you know, you're looking for like combat. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm looking for, you're not looking for combat indicators in an office environment, of course, you know, but you do get body language indicators that indicates, you know, whether they agree with the situation or whether they, you know, it kind of helps, like, you know, it gives you a little bit of sort of a bit of a forecast of what's to come, you know. And so then you can open up and go, you know, you can open up the conversation a bit more and sort of lean into it a little bit more to find out what's really going on. So but I definitely got something out of it. I put a lot in as well. I left the special constabulary in, I think it was 2017. I took a three-year break, a four-year career break from there. So I hadn't actually, well, I hadn't actually done a duty since about 2013, 2014. Saying that, though, I've had a few off-duty arrests as a civilian.
So really?
Quite interesting. But, oh, yeah, I had to catch a bag for, no, I was actually on duty. No, I was actually in the police then, yeah. That was a while back. But I had, I think, no, so what happened this year? Oh, back in May, I had a foot chase off a train.
Really?
So what happened was, I won't say what train I'm on, but basically I was on the tube train in London. You know, you get the beggars, you know, they're usually women, you know, mm-hmm. They put down a tissue bag next to you, you know, with a paper with some dialogue on it,
yeah,
to entice you. What happened, one of the passengers in front of me, so I was sitting facing forwards, I could see the train ahead of me all the way to the driver's carriage. And one of the passengers, he flashed one of these beggars. And she took offence, and she's come up to me for help. And now she couldn't even speak English. So I said, well, do you speak? I could speak a bit of schoolboy Russian. I've got a GCSE in Russian. So can you speak Russian? I said, well, I don't remember that. She might speak a bit of Russian. No. Okay. Parlez vous français? No. And she said, España. I was like, oh, you speak Spanish. And then she told me in Spanish basically what happened.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I learned a little bit of Spanish watching Netflix and whatever. yeah, you can imagine what the words she used. So
yeah.
We won't go into detail there. But I was like, right, okay. When this guy flashed her, she started spitting at him and shouting at him. He just sat there. He did nothing, which I thought was really unusual. So
yeah.
I kind of thought she was telling the truth. So I said to her, look, we've got about 5 minutes before we get to the next station. Okay, I want you to come to the front of the train with me, and then we speak to the police. I'm going to call the police now. So I moved back again about 3 or 4 metres into the next carriage because it was a Metropolitan Line train, so there were carriages already. So I moved back a little bit so I could make a phone call. And I got through to the Met Police, and I explained the circumstances, where we are. We're pulling into a station. He's probably going to make off there.
Mm-hmm.
And the police officer starts shouting at me. I'm not even joking.
Really?
She starts shouting at me, telling me to shut up. You know, sir, shut up.
Is this a 999? Is this a 999 call?
This is a 999 call. This is a 999 call.
Really?
Okay. It was 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I mean, yeah. I know there's not a lot going on at that time. Yeah, it's not too busy.
Mm.
Okay. I didn't ask for the British Transport Police, Metropolitan Police, because quite frankly, it doesn't actually make a lot of difference because that guy is going to get off the station, okay? He's going to exit. I know that from experience, and he's going to try and get away. He's not staying on the station.
Yeah.
She said to me, I should have asked for British Transport Police. And I said to her, excuse me, I don't care about distinction. I've got a suspect on the train. He's flashed a woman. She's distressed, okay? And then she cut me off.
Unbelievable.
And then I went back. Unbelievable, yeah? So I got put back to the, someone's still on the phone. I got put back to the British telecom operator, okay? Who, you know, asks you which service you acquire. And then she's put me, she said, oh, sorry, you've been cut off. I went, yeah, I know. Can you put me through again? I said, I'm going to deal with the officer later. So she put me through, back through to the British, to the Met Police again. I got through to the operator. So I just explained the circumstance. I said, look, I'm going to deal with her later, yeah, but I've got a suspect on the train. He's just flashed, okay? We're literally coming in right now into the station. So I'll give her a description. We've come into the station. Now, he must have heard me, okay? Right, so he's quickly got off, and he's trying to get on. He's gone up the staircase. I just saw the victim. I said to her, stay here. Stay on the platform, okay? Going to get the police. You stay here. He's gone up the staircase. He's crossed the ticket walls. He hasn't gone through the barriers yet. He's gone down another set of stairs to come to the opposite platform. Yeah.
Ah, right.
And he was walking really fast. And I was walking really fast after him. So I'm explaining to the operator what's going on. He realizes now I'm not letting him go. He's gone back up to the ticket hall. He's rushed through the barriers. He's exited the station. He's turned right. And this is down Finchley Road, actually, Swiss Cottage. I don't know if you know the area, but he started running towards Swiss Cottage tube station, which is like, it's about an 8 minute run, 6 minute run. And I'm like, okay, foot chase, we're running now. I've got boots on, okay? Right? These mountain boots. So they're short ankles, yeah. And I've got like 2 or 3 kilograms in my bag. This guy's got nothing. He's wearing trainers. He's quite slim. He's about my age, but he's in good, relatively good shape. I mean, he could run. We started running all around Finchley Road. And these are different. What they do when they end up on the main road and they'll step off the main road, yeah, and they'll try and go down some small roads and try and lose you there. And then they realise they get lost. They realise they don't know where they are. And then they go back up again. This always happens. They go back up to the main road again. So you double back yourself. They always do a U-turn. And then we started running, going towards Fish Cottage tube station. It was actually the next stop, but it's such a short stop. You can actually go walk from one station to the next. And at some point, we were just walking, and I was like, okay, I'm out of breath now. He's out of breath. We're walking. I'm still following him. We're passing KFC. We're now passing Specsavers. The thing is, I actually had an appointment at Specsavers. That's why I was... I had an appointment in half an hour from that time. So I've gone past Specsavers anyway. I didn't need to go in at that time. And we've both like got our breath back. And then, so then he starts running. I start running. And then we've got to Swiss Cottage tube station, just on the street level. And there's a bus there. And he got on the bus and thought, and I said to the operator, look, I'm not chasing him anymore. I'm just going to grab hold of him, right, quickly. And he's jumped on the bus, yeah, and I just grabbed hold of him. I said, I'm not letting go. And he starts saying, you're assaulted. He said, no, you've just sexually assaulted, as far as I'm concerned, that's what I suspected, yeah. You just sexually assaulted a woman on the train, and that's why I'm doing this. And I shouted this out loud because you've got to use your voice, Ben, right? When you're in those situations, you've got to use your voice because that's a good way of getting help, yeah? And it worked because I've dragged him off. I pulled down his mask. He's wearing a mask. I pulled that down so you get his face on the bus camera. Obviously, he didn't like that. And I've dragged him off the bus. And he wasn't punching me. Okay, he didn't seem to sort that word yet, but I could see where his hands were. And I kind of knew what I was doing, and I was quite happy with the risk. And then about three men come out of this local supermarket, and they just started grabbing his head. I said, what has he done? Like, you know, I said, no, don't hurt him. I said, he's actually flashed a woman, okay? And I said, I'm on the phone still. So I'm holding the guy on my left hand. I've got the phone still in my right hand up against my ear. And I managed to hold him and the phone as well while this is all going on. And then they grabbed hold of him. And then like, literally about 1 minute later, three ILVs turned up, three response vehicles had turned up. Right, I handed them over. He got arrested. And I said to the officer who I handed him over to, I said, look, I got cut off on the phone earlier, right? I said, that is not on. And he said, wow. I said, I'm really sorry about that. I said, that's going to have to be followed up. So I followed it up in a tweet, literally about an hour later. Well, I went to Specsavers because I had to collect some glasses, like I mentioned. So I walked back down the road, collect my glasses, right? Got on the train, went to my destination, another part of London. And I started tweeting, you know, I said, this wasn't on, like, what's going on? So I complained to the call centre for a tweet. And then so this whole thing happened about 11:15 on Saturday morning. About an hour and a half later, I got a phone call from the Met Police. Got a phone call from guess who? Got a phone call from the original operator who kept me off.
Really?
Right? And I was like, excuse me. You said, you got some balls giving me a call. She said, I'm sorry, you know. I said, you were shouting at me. Okay, and you cut me off. No, I couldn't hear you. No, I said, mate, you cut me off. Okay, the whole thing was recorded. I said, what you did was dangerous. You put my safety at risk. I said to her, you had no idea how that situation was going to pan out. And it ended up in a foot chase. I said to her, Wayne Cousins, that police officer who killed that Sarah Everett, that was literally 2 months after he knew that young lady was murdered. I said, he was flashing earlier that week.
Jesus. Okay.
And I said, I'm really surprised. You being a female, okay, I would have expected more from you being a woman. Right. But if you put my safety at risk, you also know that flashing is a gateway offence.
Mm.
Okay. You know how a lot of rapists and murderers transition. They start small and they actually do those sort of things. And
right. This
apparently now we know Wayne Cousins was flashing back in 2008.
Wow. Okay. Bloody
hell. That was in the news this week. I said, you weren't taking that seriously. That's really poor. And I said to her, how long have you been in the police? Oh, a few years. She's like a whimpering little puppy now. Right. And because she's trying to cover her back. Like I said, you put my safety at risk. So I said, I'm not going to be nice about this. You put my safety at risk. And then she backed down. And I said, how long have you been in the police? A couple of years. I said, how long? How many years? She said, 10 years. I said, you should know better. She said, yeah, I'm sorry. And I said, well, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Because I was absolutely livid. Okay. And I was just livid and disappointed. You know, and I said, that's it. I'm done. And then half an hour later, I get another phone call from the call centre again, the supervisor. And she said she played back the recording. She said, yeah, I heard everything that went on. I said, you're correct, you were definitely cut off. And I'm sorry about that. That shouldn't have happened. And I was just like, wow, shocked.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely just shocked and like, you know, just... Well, you don't take that seriously?
You know, especially because then you've had to deal with that situation and literally anything could have happened when you were chasing that guy.
Exactly.
You know, he could have had a weapon on him or anything, and it's not, it really isn't your responsibility to go and do that. You'd expect that the police would intervene at some point.
Yeah, Ben, you're right. You're right. But Ben, look, that guy could have been a rapist.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He could have been doing that in between the more serious offences, yeah, just to keep himself going, you know, to sort of satisfy those particular perverse urges that he had. Or, like I said, as a gateway offence, like Wayne Cousins, okay, he's going to move on to other stuff. Okay, so someone's going to get hurt. And that's the thing I found quite worrying. And as you see now in the media, quite recently as well, you know, after Wayne Cousins was actually sentenced, you can see all the questions that's opened up and all the other issues that are going on in that police and the culture as well. And I wouldn't say I've actually experienced that. I mean, when I've been on patrol, we've always taken that sort of stuff seriously.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't know what's changed. Especially a female officer with 10 years experience. I mean, so yeah, I was disappointed. But anyway, yeah, so that, I think that was leadership by example.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly that, yeah.
So yeah, the thing is, like, going back to like what the police has done, and I'm definitely a better person because of it. I'm a better person, you know, because of, you know, the training I had in the Territorial Army, the Army Reserve, and especially the Army Cadets as well. I've had some basic leadership training there as well from regular soldiers who actually seen action. You know, we go on junior leadership courses, you know, taught how to lead in the field and how to instruct as well, and just really, really good quality training. And I think you asked me a while back, actually, just while we were exchanging emails, you asked me about what sort of training I've had at, in my office, civilian role. I've had training, really, really good training. I'm just really happy with the quality of, yeah, they really do, really do care about us. And I mean that sincerely. I mean that I'm just touched by, you know, the amount of effort they put into developing and engaging us and growing us, you know, and it's something I definitely buy into, you know, for obvious reasons. I mean, it's important that that should be our focus, is how we, you know, engage with our customers as well. They're the most important people in there. We the area of working is to do with customer resilience and dealing with vulnerable customers, and the solutions that we build support that, you know, support those workflows and those conversations that our agents have. And so it's a really important function as well, you know, and something that we take very, very seriously. That's, you know, that's another reason why we get really good structured training, you know, timely training as well. And people leaders do have access to really good training. So, you know, you've got people leader fundamentals training, which I had, I think it was last year or the year before, and people excellence as well. And the people actually give that training, some of them do actually have they have military backgrounds, would have actually been in operational environments.
Right.
And I was on a course a couple of weeks ago. I was ill though, so I could only do 2 days, and the third day I was just like completely wasted. Yeah. So I couldn't complete it. It's quite irritating. But so I'm terrible with names, but it was his name was Peter. He used to be an RAF pilot, and he was shot down over the first Iraq war. And he was delivering that training, you know. And I recognised him. Obviously, I recognised the picture of him, you know, in uniform as a POW.
Yeah.
And that was just fantastic. That was top notch training. Listening for someone who's actually been in an operational environment under very extreme circumstances. And seeing that through to the end as a POW.
Do you think that kind of that part of leadership in like the army is the peak, like leadership? Do you think that's the best leadership training you'll have?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I do know a lot of enterprises, quite, you know, companies with a very large workforce. Some of them do actually value what you're talking about, you know, people from military background, leaders from military backgrounds, Amazon and Barclays as well. I do understand that they do value that, you know, and but, you know, you like I tell my engineers, I see them all as leaders as well.
Mm.
And you don't need a military background to be a leader. You can be a leader in your own right. You're an individual. You've got, you know, it's your individual traits, and your experiences that make you, you know, and that's something you actually bring to, if you were to join the military, it's something you bring to the military and they'd actually benefit from. And there is a lot of training there, you know, and, but it's I wouldn't want to say that, that it's the best training. It's very good. I wouldn't want to say it's the best because I think that'd be wrong. But it's excellent as it is, Ben, excellent as it is.
Yeah. Do you think you can learn leadership if you're not naturally a leader? Or is it, do you have to have some kind of innate leadership personality style in you?
There's a book. That's a good question.
Difficult question, that, isn't it?
I didn't think you were going to ask me that. Okay, let me answer it this way. There's a book I started reading. I say the word started, I didn't finish it. there's a book I started about a year ago called The Charisma Myth.
Okay.
And the premise of that book was that you could learn charisma.
Really?
Right?
That's...
You know, there's techniques you could learn. I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there who've had a very... the family circumstances have had very, very strong leadership, you know, characters in their family, role models, you know, immediate role models, ones that are reachable, you know. And we're not just talking people in the media, you know, as well, and in commerce and industry or the military or other services. So I'd say they've had a good start in life. And there's some people that I think still have an ability, but they just have a quite poor start in life. Mm. You know, they don't have a lot of self-confidence. They don't have a lot of the self-belief because they were just never encouraged, you know, as children, you know, maybe that their particular circumstances. And I'd hate to say your leaders were born, and I'd hate to say charisma is something you're born with as well. I don't really want to do that. I don't think I believe that. I mean, the instructor we had on that people leadership course I said I was on a couple of weeks ago, his proposition was, and certainly his belief was, that leaders are born.
Interesting.
I think if we say leaders are born, that kind of, you know, segments or a lot of it makes it difficult for people to sort of go, oh, well, I can't get there then, am I? So I haven't got it now. I mean, you know, what chance do I have? And if you look at a lot of entrepreneurs, I mean, there's a lot of entrepreneurs that are late starters and like extremely successful.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of counter examples there. So no, I wouldn't want to subscribe to that.
I've got another philosophical question for you now. Do you think it's important for a leader to be charismatic?
Helps. It can help to be charismatic. I think you want empathy, and I think you want to be able to understand people. And I mean, it helps. You know, I wouldn't say I'm charismatic. Some people said I am. I'm not sure I am. Mm. I wouldn't say I've always been charismatic. If I am charismatic, it's something I've learned. And I'm quite a chatty person, as you can realise, because I haven't been stopped talking for what 50 minutes. And it helps, you know. I'm just trying to find an example of someone who wasn't a charismatic leader. There are some leaders that aren't charismatic.
Yeah,
they can, again, in a leadership style, you know, they might work for that environment, and you know, and then just the people around it, they're quite happy to be led in that way, so to speak. You know, it's a difficult question. I haven't quite answered it.
I didn't realise, you know, before I started doing these podcasts quite a while ago now, I've spoken to a lot of leaders on this show. And before I started doing these recordings, I mean, you know, during these, I've learned so much about leadership, and I had no idea how much emotional intelligence leaders have to have. It's incredible how much empathy and how much kind of personability leaders have to have. It fascinates me. I had no idea before I started doing these recordings that's the case, but...
I think if that's lacking, you're going to have difficulty,
you know,
getting people to walk with you, you know, on that journey, whatever that goal or whatever that vision is, you have difficulty doing that, you know. Sometimes you have to make hard decisions like, no, we need to do this, you know, it's going to be, this is, otherwise we're not going to be able to function, you know. But I do, how can I say, I always make sure people have capital in what they're doing. I always look for opportunities for me to delegate work and actually give people ownership and accountability. I mean, I imagine a lot of people say that, but it's true, you know, it's really true. It's like if you own your home, you're going to take care of it, aren't you?
Yeah.
Versus, I'm sure people who rent their homes will obviously take care, but you get the analogy, you know, you're going to be a bit more, you're more invested in it, you know, you're going to, you know, you're going to tackle things quite early. Yeah. And you're going to take the long view, and you know it's something you're investing in yourself as well. So I always make sure people have capital for what they're doing. And it's a conversation I'll have with our stakeholders as well. So I make sure they're aware of that too, that, you know, engineers, not just about giving people work, it's about giving them opportunities of growth. And it's like, if a piece of work is quite mundane, how can we change that? You know, can we split that up, you know, just distribute that across the team? I always look at the work I've got. I don't, if I've got something that's quite mundane and one-off, you know, those types of sort of work, you know, that sort of work, I wouldn't give that, I wouldn't delegate that to anybody in my team. There's no way I would ask someone to fill out a spreadsheet. Like, if it's a one-off, and then I might as well do it myself. What is that person going to learn from doing that? Are they going to learn anything from it? Is there something that they really do need to know? Because I have to do some work as well, Ben. You know?
That's true.
I can't sit in meetings all day and talk. And, you know, although meetings are beneficial, of course, you know, but I'm quite cognizant that I actually have to do some work. And if I do have to find something out as well, I'll go and have a crack myself first while sort of pestering people on my team to go find it out. I'll always go and try to find out myself as well, you know. I think people appreciate that. And I think, you know, they appreciate being trusted as well, and giving people ownership, giving them capital means what they're doing means you trust them, and getting them as well to speak to the stakeholders directly. I don't want to be the middle person. I want to know what's going on and keep me informed. But I really do want people to know who's doing this, who's delivering this, who is the person or the people behind this.
Yeah.
And I want the stakeholders to know that. I really want everybody to know in our goal team on Trump who's actually doing that, because that's really important. I'll never take the credit for something I didn't build myself. I can never take the credit. I don't like that.
So you say you never take credit for something you've not built yourself, but as a leader, say if something goes wrong in that situation or wrong with that.
then I take credit for that. That's part and parcel of the job, you know. So if I've made a mistake, I have to take the hits. That's my responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, but if it's a learning opportunity, it's a learning opportunity. Okay. That's a good point. I'd never make anyone pay for what they've done. I always make them responsible. Okay. And there's a difference.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm ultimately responsible, you know, for things going wrong. So I have to take the hit, and, you know, you just have to take it on the chin, and that's it. So if someone's got something to say to one of my engineers, they have to speak to me about it. Okay. If they've got a complaint, they have to come speak to me and I'll deal with it. I don't want them remonstrating. I don't want them speaking in terms that you wouldn't normally do in front of other people. That's important as well. You know, I never take things personally anyway, so it's that's a good point. But no, you have to, as a leader, you have to take responsibility, you know, and use it as a learning opportunity. So the thing there to learn, you know, some reflection, and we do that, make sure you just don't repeat it again. So that's just taking ownership and not being made, you know, to pay for it, being made, you know, fix it. Yeah.
There's another part of leadership which is kind of similar to charisma. So it's, you know, you were saying you don't have to be charismatic, but it helps in leadership, helps, you know, get people on your side. Is it the same as being likable? And also, so then do you have to open yourself up to being not liked, essentially?
You're there to be liked. People won't necessarily respect you because they like you.
Yeah.
They respect you because you know how to make a decision.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what they need. They respect you because you trust them. They respect you because you don't necessarily have to lead all the conversations. You don't have to make the final decision. Sometimes you can defer that to the team and just allow them to sort of, you know, reach consensus. And that can be difficult sometimes, you know, because sometimes people don't agree all the time. So, you know, I'm not going to go into details, but, you know, there's been situations where it's like, well, actually, I'm hearing different things from different team members, and I think we probably want to do this, you know, and I know not everyone's going to like it, and you just have to do it, and it hurts, but they do trust you, and, you know, they do realise you do have their back, but sometimes they can't have their way all the time, because you're not going to be able to please everybody all the time, Ben, as you know, and you're not there to do that, and I think that's important. So I think if you're looking for people to like you, that's not a good way to go about things.
Look for people to respect
you. Respect you, and trust you as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you, I mean, like, I think everybody on the planet has experienced bad leadership, but there's actually a lot of positives to come from bad leadership because you can learn a lot from it. Have you experienced bad leadership? And if you have you learned anything from it as well?
Yeah, I've had interesting leaders, managers. I mean, I had one that wouldn't, this is not recent, so in case anyone's listening, not recent, so you won't be able to figure out who it was. I had one where he wouldn't even talk to me. Literally, we're in a room together. There's like on my desk here, and then there's the desk in front. He's there, we've got these big CRT, you know, we had big monitors like decades ago, like, you know.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't even talk to us. He would send us emails, like we sat there and we were just like, well, can you not like talk to us?
So
weird. That's like, that was so weird, you know. It's like, he was a nice guy. I think he was a likable guy. We kind of liked him, you see, you know. And I think he was afraid to sort of, he was quite shy as well, you know. And but then he would bottle things up and he wouldn't actually tell you what he was thinking, or if we were, you know, coming in, you know, 10 minutes late for what were late for him. You know, we were working longer hours. I mean, you know, it wasn't the case of, but we felt we had a bit of flexibility there. You know, he never even challenged it. But he never challenged it. And he never actually, you know, said, look, guys, I'm not happy with this. Like, you need to come in at 9 o'clock on the dot, not 9:15.
Yeah.
You know? And he never said that. And then we're all coming at 9:15 or a little bit. But we work during lunchtime. Sometimes we work a little bit later on past the, you know, 5 o'clock. Yeah. And so we were committed. He'd bottle things up and not communicate to us. And I think that's important as well, is communication, you know. And,
absolutely.
I'd say he lacked charisma. I liked him, but I didn't appreciate the lack of communication. I mean, he'd send me like work items via email, and he's like sat right in front of me. That's how it would happen, you know. It's like, get a whiteboard up and let's break this down. Let's talk, you know. Let's collaborate.
Yeah.
And so there was none of that self-organizing, and there was none of that sort of like, hey, look, I want you to be responsible for this. Go away and think about how you do this.
Mm.
It's like, here's a piece of work. You just get these little spoonfuls of work coming your way each time. It's like, open your mouth, in it goes, you know. And,
yeah.
And basically, that wasn't a great experience, and that was a poor example of leadership and probably management as well. And I think there's a difference between them. Maybe we haven't got time to go through that. But
that's a whole different podcast in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
but I mean, I do want to ask. You mentioned communication as well there in leadership, and you know, with the pandemic and teams were kind of physically separated or working from home, communication is very, very different there. So you kind of almost had to resort back to the leadership style that you experienced, where it's emails and things like that. Obviously, we've got Zooms and stuff and Slack. It makes it a lot slicker. But yeah, how did the pandemic affect?
You're right. Yeah, so good point. No, I mean, I'd never communicated people via email. I mean, I wouldn't send any. I can't remember. I probably sent an email to people in my team probably about twice in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Right.
About 2 or 3 emails. That's it.
Wow.
I mean, that's to give you an example. Mm. I like to talk.
Yeah.
So we got our, you know, we're an agile team. So we use Scrum. We follow the Scrum methodology, and we've got all our ceremonies in place. We talk about, you know, I'm not a great fan of emails. They're very sort of isolating. They're very cold. Sometimes you want to maybe have a discussion. You want to put it in email, the bullet points, and that's fine. You know, here's just a roundup of what we discussed. And there's so many emails flying around, and it's like you get lost in them, and it's like, do you actually need to be in them as well? But
yeah.
I mean, coming back to your question though, right? We would collaborate via, we would have a Zoom and we would talk and we would throw up a Jamboard, or we've been using Jamboards a lot more.
Cool.
Obviously, because like, you know, we hardly used Jamboards before. We never really needed to, but we started leaning into Jamboards and visualizing stuff as well, and looking for ways, you know, we're refining work as well. We need a visual first approach to the way we refine work. And that's really, really helped. I mean, that to me, obviously I'm slightly biased because I like that way of working, you know? I think one of the issues we had as well is we had a lot of young engineers in the team, so grads, and some of them would be living by themselves, and they're literally thousands of miles away from home and family, and they're trapped in Japan, they can't travel back. They're very isolated. They can't go to bars, everything's shut down. They can't go to the office, and they're just in their little home, in their little flat by themselves, a small flat.
Yeah.
In Canary Wharf by themselves, isolated. And I mean, that would have been quite challenging, to make sure they're included as well. I was okay. I mean, I've got a partner, some people are married, they've got kids, and yeah, they had some sort of, you know, support there, you know. So, the younger staff and those people that were, you know, from London and they're living by themselves would have found it more challenging.
Yeah.
And the team come up with different ideas. So we'd have like team socials, we get together every week, you know, we do games, we just have some fun together, you know. And,
yeah.
And that was definitely good for those that, it was good for me as well. It was fun. I never knew all these board games you could play online. You know? shows how old I am. So make sure inclusion's still there, you know, people aren't being left out. And I said I was always available, you know, to talk to people or something, have a chat after work. And sometimes we do some, I did pair programming once as well. I don't actually contribute, but I did pair programming with a grad. Last year, I graduated my team, and I really enjoyed that, you know. And, so I've done that in years. I think it's interesting now because we're all trying to get back into the office. It's like the question was before, like you said, is like, how do we work from home? You know, how do we do that? I mean, we figured out how we did that. But also, Ben, it was quite a leveling, it was quite. It kind of set a level playing field because, our office is quite small. You know, and our head office is in another city, up north, and we've got like 45 plus development teams, and we had about 7 in London. And so before, you know, we'd have the community of practice meetings, like you have like 50, 60, 70 people online in one meeting room up north, and then we would actually have to log on. We felt quite isolated. It's very difficult to hear people as well. But now everybody's at home.
Mm-hmm.
On Zoom, okay, and we can actually communicate better as well.
Yeah,
it's just a lot easier. So it's set a level playing field. So no one had any particular advantages because of their location. But I think the question is now is like, how do we've solved the sort of working from home aspect, you know, challenge, you know, we learn as we went along, and you know, we introduce different sort of ceremonies, you know, at team level and a goal, you know, and a multi-team level too. But the question now is like, how do we work from the office?
Yeah.
So now we've gone back. That's the challenge, and it's really difficult because we got a hybrid approach at the moment, and we don't know what working, you know, what that's going to look like in the new year. We just don't know yet. It's something. Yep. A lot of companies are experimenting with, and at the moment it is actually completely optional if you want to go into the office. So it's up to the teams to decide, the individuals, and there's no particular pressure. I think that's a really good approach. Some people like working from home. I think for a lot of types of meetings or types of interactions, it makes sense to work from home. You know, I mean, who wants to go in, jump on the train to have a meeting in a room with another 10 people, have a few of those, and then jump back on the train again? You might as well do that from home, you know. So I think it's gonna change the way we organize our interactions as well. And that'd be quite interesting.
Yeah, I do find as well Zoom meetings, although they are painful sometimes, but there is pros to them. I mean, I do find with Zoom meetings, like you did mention it levels the playing field for everybody. And also I find Zoom meetings more concise than in-person meetings. You know, that's a pro, but it's also a con. But yeah, it is going to be interesting. And especially you mentioned people enjoy working from home. And, you know, I was thinking people might be enjoying that now because we've not been working from home for that long a period of time. But I'm just really wondering where the dust is going to settle in 3-4 years' time with people saying they enjoy working from home now. What the hell is that going to be like? Are those people going to be recluses or are they going to find some kind of balance there, you know?
It's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It kind of worries me a bit, in a way.
The office experience, you know, and actually you know, being able to read body language as well is a really important skill, you know. So you're not going to, on Zoom, what you're going to see is the face, and you might see the hands, you know, we're touching our like you're touching your beard there and your chin, you know, and you're looking, you're leaning in, you're interested.
Yep,
I hope you are, anyway. you know, you can't see the rest because, like, you get body language below the waist, you know, you're crossing your legs, and, like, tapping your feet, and the way you're pointing as well is really important to sort of, you know, sort of pick up on those things. I know they're quite basic, but they're important, you know, it's something to learn. But also the office experience, you know, we've got grants joining, we've got permanent, we've got professional hires as well, you know, from the market. We've never met before. You know, well, I have met them right now, but obviously, like, a few weeks ago, so that's when we went back to the office. Actually, last month we started going back to the office, but they miss that office experience. So they miss those casual sort of conversations, you know, they miss those casual sort of on-plan meetings with, like, senior leaders, you know, and it's quite energizing as well, you know, to meet a director and to be engaged by a director. So, like, who are you? Oh, right, what are you doing? And it's quite energizing, you know, you can feel the confidence, you can feel the energy, you know, in the senior leaders, and they're missing out on that, I think, some of them. And obviously some of us don't need that. I still enjoy it, of course. I mean, it's unfortunate. I feel like the younger staff, you know, the ones that haven't been in the workforce for that long are impoverished because of it. And they're the ones that tend to be quite keen to get in the office.
Yeah.
You know, to meet other people, to socialize, you know, develop skills, you know, that they've, you know, they're still developing. And to have that office experience. And to feel part of a larger thing, you know. I do feel part of something personally, you know, even though on Zoom, you know, but I just actually enjoyed going back to the office. I'm just to socialize, just to meet people. As you know, Ben, we're social animals, you know, and we've evolved, and we've been successful as species is because we're social animals. That's part of our success.
Yeah.
And it's something that we still need to do to be successful, I'd argue, in some respects. I suspect a lot of or industry in general will sort of look at hybrid working as the default as opposed to exception. And that's what I'd like to see, you know. And there's people whose personal circumstances are quite difficult, where it kind of, it makes sense for them to be able to have the option to work from home and for it not to be impoverished or to, and there's challenges around that as well. You want to make sure there's no distance bias as well. So we need to make sure our biases are not sort of, you know, taking hold, you know, and that, you know, someone working from home isn't being disadvantaged, you know, because they're, like, further away, so to speak. And so there's other challenges there. And
There's a lot of challenges around it, definitely. And I think, you know, some arguments people might say from working from home is better because people might say, I get a lot more work done. You know, I don't have the commute. I'm not wasting time chatting to people. But I think with any kind of role, it's not always just about the output of your work, really. You've got to enjoy what you do, and you have to have a kind of collaboration feel almost. So it's not always just about how much output, you know, working from home compared to working in the office has. It's more than that, isn't it?
You're right, Ben. You're right. I think if it's the individual, depends what their goals are, you know. I mean, your software developers like writing software, you know, but, you know, quality software is not just about writing code, it's about the process that you use to get that code into production as well, you know. And, you know, there's initial interactions, you know, because, like I say, quality is something that starts at the beginning, not the end, you know. And you know, that's something we practice at Capital One as well. We're quite fervent about that. You know, so I mean, for the interactions, you know, the brainstorming, the creativity, it's good to get people in a room, you know, and that doesn't have to happen very often, you know. It's so, once you understand what you need to build and everyone understands what we need to build, and we all have the same picture in our minds, then we can, you know, then working from home can make sense in a lot of circumstances and you know, at different times during projects. I'm up for that. I like working from home, but I also like meeting people in the office. I want to find out who the new... I there's people I haven't even met or been aware of who've been in teams. Yeah. It's very difficult to get a feel for who's new from an email or from, you know, a Zoom presentation or a town hall, you know. And like I said earlier, it's good for staff to get access to senior leaders, our leadership team in London, and also a leadership team of our company as well. You'd actually meet the CEO. You could actually talk to the CEO of our company in the office. and she would entertain you, you know, and she would, like, you felt, you know, valuable and wanted, and, you know, that's really important that people get that, because, you know, there's a lot of disconnect in large organizations.
Yeah.
But that I thought that was really cool. That was quite, impressive.
Yeah. It's really interesting, Shane. I've got about 1,000 questions in my head that I want to ask you, but I'm well aware that you're a very busy guy and I've taken up too much of your time already. So I'm sorry.
We've done a good job here, I think, over an hour. So.
Oh yeah. But hasn't it
you've got a lot of editing to do. It's flown by. Yeah. It's been good. I appreciate your questions as well. And, filling up with my chattering.
No, honestly, it's fascinating, Shane. Honestly, it's fascinating. You've got a lot to say, but I'm really interested in it.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.